Good afternoon. This is the Maggie Dawn Show on these broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you joining us for this beautiful afternoon in the state of Wisconsin and elsewhere. My name is Jim Santel, and I'm going to be with you here this hour and next hour as well on this, the Maggie Dawn Show. Maggie is away today and has invited me to take her chair, take her place, and spend some time with you this afternoon in talking all about the major issues of our day. Delighted to be with you and delighted to have you with us as well. I'm joined here in the studios of WAUK in Waukesha, but studios throughout the state of Wisconsin by my spectacular producer. Her name is Anya, joined today also by Jess. The two of them are going to keep me online and on track throughout this hour and next hour as well on this, the Maggie Dawn Show. Again, inviting, as always, your comments, your questions, especially your inquiries about things that we're talking about. That phone number is 855-752-4842. Once more, that's 855-752-4842. Join us in our discussion this afternoon, or you can also drop a comment into the Civic Media app, a comment, a question, an inquiry about the subject matter on our agenda for this afternoon. Throughout the day today, the next 2 hours, we're also going to be celebrating the wonderful work and the traditions, and yes, the music of Carole King, one of my very favorites throughout my life, 82 years old, born on February 9th of 1942. She is one of the most successful songwriters in the latter half of the 20th century, and yes, the first years of this century as well. Co-wrote or produced 118 hits on the Billboard Hit 100. And she also wrote 60 hits that charted in the United Kingdom, making her the most successful songwriter on the UK singles chart between 1962 and 2005. Carole King has made 25 solo albums, the most successful being Tapestry, a classic in the music lexicon of our nation and of the world, held the record for most weeks at the number one by a female artist for more than 20 years. Her record sales were estimated more than 75 million copies worldwide. And yes, in addition to being wildly popular, this tremendous musician, this song stylist who animates our lives and our livelihood to this day, she has also been recognized for all of that too. Four Grammy Awards, inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, inducted twice into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and as a performer and a songwriter. She is the recipient of the 2013 Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for Popular Song. She was the first woman to be so honored. Let's talk about that for just a moment as we celebrate here on the Maggie Dawn Show the work, the life, the music of Carole King. The Librarian of Congress, his name is James Billington, said this. He said, Carole King has been one of the most influential songwriters of our time. For more than 5 decades, she has written for and been recorded by many different types of artists for a wide range of audiences, communicating with beauty and dignity, the universal human emotions of love and joy and pain and loss. Her body of work reflects the spirit of the Gershwin Prize with its originality, its longevity, and the diversity of its appeal. Indeed, at the time of the announcement of that award, President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama hosted that ceremony, a concert at the White House, May 22, 2013, presenting her with that prize and reading the citation. In May, Carole King received an honorary doctorate of music from the Berklee College of Music, and in June of 2013, campaigned in Massachusetts for many very important causes, continues to do that to this day. For those of you, the few among you who may not be familiar with this icon in American music history, in American history generally, you should also know that from the 1970s, she appeared in the Mary Tyler Moore Show as a guest playing Aunt Helen. In the 1980s, she was on the Tracy Ullman Show, appearing as Joan, an anonymous member of the cast at that time. And much more recently, in the aughts of this century, the Gilmore Girls. She appeared multiple times is a character named Sophie Bloom. We celebrate today, as a part of our Maggie Dawn show, the life, the livelihood, the continuing work, the continuing vitality of Carole King, major, major American singer-songwriter in our history. A musician has truly, truly transformed who we are and the ways we think not only about music, but about the ways in which we live. Most appropriate today, as we talk this afternoon about other things, other events that are also animating and changing the world in which we live. Maggie has invited me this afternoon to be with you. Again, inviting also your comments, your questions at 855-752-4842. And let me tell you about the agenda that will animate perhaps most of our first hour this afternoon, and then also the second hour here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Some events, some issues happening, some significant occurrences just today and yesterday in the life and livelihood of our nation. A major Supreme Court case issued just this morning. Yes, that's right. We're in that time period now, that time period in late May and June when the Supreme Court begins to issue many of its major cases. A major case today, 7-2 is the vote, upholding the constitutionality of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We'll talk all about that. We'll talk about the author of that opinion. The author, which may surprise you, from the Supreme Court, and we'll talk about what it means in terms of future cases that also affect the role of agencies and administrative actions in our nation. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Of course, the trial of Donald Trump in that Manhattan criminal courtroom continues even as we are on the air, joining you on the air this afternoon, Michael Cohen testifying, the former fixer, the former attorney for the defendant, Donald Trump, talking all about his relationship, the events, the activities that animated that relationship for many years before it went badly. And Michael Cohen, again on cross-examination, talking today about the meaning of lying, not only to Congress, but to other officials, and in so doing, not only establishing a key element of the government's case, the state's case here, describing the transactions involving these hush money payments in which he was a principal player along with others, but also talking about himself and along the way describing those things that are unpleasant, that are unattractive, that are even dismaying in many ways, reasons not to believe Michael Cohen, but that also in the end make him a credible witness by virtue of the candor that he is bringing, even as we are on the air today, to his testimony. That testimony probably the last witness in this trial, the trial probably concluding sometime next week. We will see whether there is a defense case that follows sometime soon, assuming this gets to a verdict, and every indication now that Judge Juan Merchan, presiding over that case, is indeed going to send this off to the jury fairly soon. We may have a verdict sometime in the next week or two, first time in American history in which a former president on trial for crimes in a courtroom in America, a verdict coming up fairly soon. But today, the testimony of Michael Cohen continues. And third, also just breaking yesterday and today, the invocation of a concept called executive privilege by, yes, the Biden administration to keep a certain videotape of the president's testimony in connection with an investigation by another special counsel into his possession, acquisition, and his continuing work with some documents that he took from the White House when he was vice president. We'll talk about the implications of the invocation by the attorney general and, yes, by the White House of the executive privilege concept, how it has been used in the past also by previous presidents, including, yes, that's right, Donald Trump and Barack Obama and probably every other major contemporary presidency of recent times. Executive privilege invoked just today, just yesterday, to prevent the United States Congress from getting its hands not on the transcript of that testimony, but of the video of that testimony. We'll talk about what that means. All of those things coming up in this, the first hour of the Maggie Dawn Show. My name, once again, Jim Santel, guest hosting for Maggie today as she is away. Inviting, as always, your calls at 855-752-4842, or also drop to Anya, drop to Jess, drop to me a comment in the Civic Media app, and we will talk with you in response to those questions as well. Let us begin by talking about this major development just hours ago coming out of our United States Supreme Court. And yes, indeed, it is, as I said, that time of year. It's always mid-May. It's always into June when the Supreme Court, the highest court in our land, begins to issue some landmark opinions. This term, the 2023-2024 term, no exception to that rule. And we have talked on this broadcast and other broadcasts of civic media all about the 62 cases that the Supreme Court has taken under its wing, under its review this term. And specifically, a number of those cases having to do with the role of agencies, the role of our administrative practices in this nation, attacks based upon unfounded and insignificant attacks, nonetheless, on the legitimacy of our agencies and the way that which they do their business today. Not surprisingly, after an oral argument of many weeks ago, the Supreme Court affirming the legitimacy of something called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This decision, 7-2, a 7-2 vote, two members of the Supreme Court, we'll tell you who they are, seven members of the Supreme Court affirming the legitimacy, affirming the rightness of the way in which Congress created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the way in particular that it is funded. And yes, that was the issue. That was the attack on the CFPB that was launched in this litigation that finally made its way to the United States Supreme Court. It could have hobbled this bureau and advancing this central goal of many illegal conservative movements, that is to limit the power of independent agencies. We have seen this in the political arena as an attack on the so-called administrative state that does, in fact, not exist. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court has chosen to review three cases in this term. Today, just hours ago, the Supreme Court affirming the legitimacy of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in ways that we will describe here on our afternoon broadcast. A vote 7-2, Justice Clarence Thomas writing for the majority, supporting the constitutionality of the CFPB. Stay with us for more of that discussion here on the Maggie Dawn Show, all about this major case coming out of our high court.
Under my feet, I feel the sky tumbling down. I feel my heart start to tremble whenever you're around. Oh, baby, when I see your face, mellow as the month of May. Winter, spring, summer, or fall.
That, the amazing music of Carole King, this song stylist who animates much of our contemporary life, featuring her music today on The Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel. I am sitting in this afternoon for this hour and next hour, along with my terrific producer, Anya and Jess. They're going to also invite your comments, your texts, your questions, your insights at 855-752-1842. You can drop a comment to us and we will chat with you about the subject matter of our discussion on this, The Maggie Dawn Show, on this afternoon, beginning to talk about this major case coming out of the United States Supreme Court just this morning, just hours ago, in this case involving the legitimacy of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The vote, 7-2, Clarence Thomas, writing the majority opinion, a conservative justice, as those descriptions are sometimes placed on him. Had the Bureau lost, had the arguments in favor of getting rid of the Bureau, challenging its legitimacy, the courts really might have cast doubt on every single regulation and enforcement action the CFPB has taken in the 13 years, that's right, 13 years of its existence, including rules and decisions in areas of mortgages and credit cards, consumer loans, banking, all kinds of things within the commission of the CFPB. The central question in this case was whether the way in which Congress chose to fund the CFPB, how did it fund the institution itself, get it to provide money for its operation on a regular basis, whether it violated the appropriations clause of the United States Constitution, which says that no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. That's James Madison talking to us over the many, many years, about 240 years altogether. That's the appropriation clause. that contemplates that the United States Congress will fund institutions of government. In this particular case, the decision by the Congress when it created the CFPB was to fund it through funding through monetary support of another institution. Under the Appropriations Clause, Justice Thomas wrote, an appropriation is simply a law that authorizes expenditures from a specified source of public money for designated purposes. Very significant. He says the statute that provides the Bureau's funding meets these requirements. We therefore conclude, he wrote, that the Bureau's funding mechanism does not violate the Appropriations Clause. The agency, of course, welcoming that decision, not surprisingly, acknowledging that these sort of sustained attacks on it had over time done a lot to compromise, at least in the public view, the legitimacy of its actions. A lot of that going away today. Critics of the agency call the ruling a missed opportunity. There is a fellow named Dan Greenberg. He's counsel for something called the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He said this decision marks an alarming failure by the courts to police the proper exercise of Congress's constitutional power. The Bureau, contrary to what he said, was legitimately, appropriately, constitutionally constituted. That's what the Supreme Court tells us today after the financial crisis and as a part of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act. Remember that legislation? It is not funded by annual appropriations, but rather through this somewhat atypical arrangement, but not unique, in which it draws its resources from, yes, another entity up to a certain annual cap, and it draws those resources from something called the Federal Reserve. You know them well, the Federal Reserve System. That system, in turn, and this is a part of the challenge brought before the Supreme Court, does not receive congressional appropriations, financed instead by interest on securities it holds and gains from those securities, some transactions and other sources overall. Justice Thomas wrote that the question in the case was a narrow one that had, as he said, an identified source and a purpose, all that is required for a valid appropriation. And he surveyed, as Justice Thomas and other members of the Supreme Court often do, the history of the creation of the CFPB, analogies from English, colonial, and even American history. Yes, that's right. Going back in time once again. A concurring opinion, that is the opinion of other justices among the group of seven that today affirmed the constitutionality of this agency. Justice Elena Kagan, joined by Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, added that more recent history also supports that agency. Justice Kagan said this. She said, the way our government has actually worked over our entire experience thus provides another reason to uphold Congress's decision about how to fund the CFPB. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, the newest member of the Supreme Court, wrote that the court should not, as she said, undercut the considered judgment of a coordinate branch, that's Congress, about how to respond to a pressing national concern. Now, there were plainly two members of the Supreme Court who disagree with this result. We know who they are. Justice Alito, in dissent, wrote that the framers would be shocked, he said. They would be shocked today, even horrified by this scheme. In sum, he said, the CFPB's unprecedented combination of funding features affords it the very kind of financial independence that the Appropriations Clause, again invoking the Constitution, was designed to prevent. It is not an exaggeration. Again, this is Alito talking here, to say that the CFPB enjoys a degree of financial autonomy that a Stuart King would envy. A little bit of hyperbole there from one member of the Supreme Court. A unanimous three-judge panel before the decision today of, yes, that's right, the Fifth Circuit had ruled way back in 2022 that the CFPB's funding method did, in fact, run afoul of the Appropriations Clause. That Fifth Circuit decision now soundly, clearly overturned by the United States Supreme Court. In this major case, important not only for the continued vitality on behalf of all of us who are responsible to ensure through government that rules and regulations of financial institutions are properly adhered to, for the benefit of all of us in the financial areas generally, mortgages, loans, all kinds of things the CFPB issues rules and directives on, all of that effectively affirmed today by virtue of this major opinion. And why is it an important opinion, not only with respect to the CFPB, but because it also falls in the midst, as I indicated before, of this continuing so-called attack on our federal agencies, an attack that is political in nature. We know that Donald Trump, who is one of the candidates for the presidency right now, continues to talk on a regular basis about the illegitimacy of our agencies in the federal system. He talks about these unidentified experts inside agencies who are doing things without disclosure. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. These are, as we know, civil servants. They're appointed, they're employed on by you to work on behalf of the American population to ensure that the rules and laws of our nation are properly enforced. And they do that every single day in the exercise of that discretion given to them by the Congress, given them by the CFPB leadership, today affirmed. Now, why is that additionally important? Why is this case among the three? It is among these three cases that inside the Supreme Court also codify this attack upon our administrative agencies. Two other cases also pending that we'll anticipate coming out sometime soon. An attack upon the Securities and Exchange Commission also coming up sometime soon. And yes, a major attack on the very ways in which federal courts understand the work of our federal agencies. That an attack on something called the Chevron Doctrine. And will change, if the Supreme Court goes down this road, the ways in which courts interact with agencies and the extent to which agencies have the permission and the authority to act on our behalf. More on all of that on other rule of law events this day here on the Maggie Dawn Show as we continue our discussion on these civic media broadcast stations. Featuring this hour and next hour, the fantastic music of Carole King here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel. I am guest hosting the Maggie Dawn Show this hour and next hour as well. Delighted, honored to have you with me and my spectacular producer, Anya. We are, as always, taking your inquiries and your questions at 855-752-4842. Or you can also drop us a text, a comment on the Civic Media app. Delighted as we talk today in this, the first hour, about some major events happening in the areas of law and justice and the rule of law. This Supreme Court case coming out just this morning, finding that the CFPB is in fact constitutionally put together and pushing back on this challenge, attacking at least this agency when it comes to a decision by our United States Supreme Court. It's a big deal. It's one of 60 cases. 60 cases the Supreme Court is addressing this term. They've got about 40 more cases to decide between now and probably mid to late June or so. Lots of things going on coming out of the Supreme Court between now and then. Lots of things on the broadcast stations of Civic Media to be very attentive to. And we are delighted to have your phone calls and your inquiries. Delighted this afternoon to have Greg from Waukesha a part of our conversation. Greg, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jim. Pleasure to talk to you. I think I've met you once in person, and it's a great pleasure to talk with you.
My pleasure as well.
You know, as someone who benefits from some of these programs and agencies offered by the federal government, specifically Social Security Administration and other things. My concern, though, Jim, with keeping, you know, and you talked about, you know, funding and things like that. My concern is these constant government shutdowns that keep taking place, that the government is not being fully funded. And I will listen in off air, but I was wondering if you had like a reason, or maybe there is something historical because we've never seen this before in the past, right? Government shutdowns as we've experience. So maybe there's some historic things that I'm missing. So, and great job, Jim, as always. I always benefit from listening to your show. And yes, Carole King, she's definitely queen.
She is the best, right, Greg? Thank you so much, Emily, for your nice comments about our show today and in other venues, but also your very thoughtful and very direct comment about the larger issue here, which is, yes, agencies work on behalf of the people of the United States of America. Are they perfect? Do they make mistakes? Yes, they make mistakes routinely. And that's why we've got the courts to address those issues, all kinds of process out there. But these attacks on the administrative state, so-called, is really that the attacks generally are not only disquieting, they're concerning, and they really go to undermine the fundamental operations of our government. You raise a much related issue, even a more cosmic issue, which has to do with this fact that the Congress, for many years now, it is not historic, but for many years now, has failed to do something that's established by Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States of America, and that is to put together a budget for the operation of the federal government. And you can tell already, Greg, I think you and I have chatted about this, as we have with others, the frustration that all Americans should have about these constant coming up to the Thursday night, the Friday night, the Saturday night, the midnight deadlines for keeping our government in place. It is no way to run any operation. And beyond that, the argument can be made that when Congress, however you may choose to describe it, Republicans, Democrats alike, fail to do this fundamental thing that keeps our government in operation. As you said, Greg, places and institutions like the Social Security Administration and others like the Housing and Urban Development Department, the Department of Agriculture, State and Justice, Commerce, Labor, all those agencies, and yes, all sorts of other independent agencies brought to a close very often when that funding source does not continue, when the funding stream is broken off because Congress doesn't do its constitutional duty not only to identify funding bills, to pass them, to make these appropriations that were in part the subject of today's opinion from the Supreme Court. But failing to do that, they're failing all of us. And I would offer to you, consistent, Greg, with what you just articulated, that your views should be the source of outrage for all Americans. Regardless of party, Republicans, Democrats, other members of other parties, everyone should look to our representatives and say at least this. We can disagree about policy in the areas of education and agriculture and environment and immigration and foreign policy, domestic issues, all kinds of things. But your role, at a minimum, the first thing on your list has got to be to do what the Constitution prescribes, and that is in the House of Representatives, begin to author those appropriations bills, those authorization bills that keep the government in place. Send that over to the Senate. That's how the Constitution contemplates this is done. And yes, indeed, go into conference to iron out the differences between that. Get those to a president and have that president sign off on those bills and to do it timely. If one thinks, Greg, and I think it's implicit in your very good comment about any other institution, those of you who are in academia, as I believe you are, Greg, those of you who are in business generally out there, you have a budget every single year. You've got a board of directors. Can you imagine coming to the board of directors, coming to the trustees, coming to your employees and saying, you know, it's 3 days out. We just didn't have time to put together a budget. So we may be shutting down in a few days because we didn't do our job. I would offer that there is no other institution, certainly in our nation, across the globe that operates in that function, in that manner. Why is it? Why is it that we tolerate that on behalf of the people of the United States of America, that misbehavior, that misconduct under the Constitution by our United States Congress? The point is very important. And yes, indeed, the failure of Congress to do that has real-world implications for people who are counting upon the federal government to act, not only in the area of benefits, but also basic services, basic support, basic programs that we talk a lot about here on the civic media broadcast stations. A very important point. The outrage should be real. even as the Supreme Court continues to address these much-related issues about the continued vitality of other agencies. I mentioned this case involving the SEC. It's coming up again soon in that particular matter. Supreme Court far less clear from its oral argument about whether it will continue the vitality of the Securities and Exchange Commission around for over 100 years, addressing this issue about whether or not there's a Seventh Amendment jury trial inside the administrative operation of the SEC, that issue coming up for resolution. And again, this larger issue is in a case called Loper Bright Enterprises that we'll also talk about whether or not in general, after 40 years of a doctrine called Chevron, the United States Supreme Court should dropkick that and say that federal courts no longer need to defer to the experts, the people who are experienced, who know what they're doing inside agencies, when those experts articulate and advance reasonable interpretations of the law. That concept, called the Chevron Doctrine, is in jeopardy right now. We'll see what the United States Supreme Court does in both of those other cases. Again, it is inside our Supreme Court, this attack on administrative agencies. It is not healthy for our nation. And these other two cases may not go in the same direction as the CFPB case goes today. The Supreme Court may well find that these other agencies, the one involving Loper Bright has to do with the National Fisheries Agency, may well find that indeed the federal courts should not defer to federal agencies and the expertise, the learned background of people, civil servants for years and years and years doing decent and honorable work. Not without some mistakes from time to time, but pretty close to doing an outstanding job on behalf of the American population. That is in jeopardy right now. As all of this goes forward, we continue to engage with you in discussion. We're delighted right now to have from Milwaukee, Karina calling in. Karina, thanks for calling in to the Maggie Dawn Show this afternoon.
Hi. I have a question, which I always ask myself, and I probably don't have enough information to answer it. So I know that the Congress over the years borrowed money from Social Security. I don't think they ever gave it back, did they?
Lots and lots of things to unpack there, right? Exactly. Social Security obviously funded by employees across the board. Whether you are in private industry or in government, you basically contribute to Social Security over the lifetime of your employment. That's how it gets funded. And lots of recent attention to the continued vitality of the Social Security Administration. Karina, perhaps this is what animates your question today about whether or not those funds will be available down the road. A recent report indicating that well into the 2030s, the mid to late 2030s, Social Security, by virtue of payments made by present employees funding those people who are getting Social Security benefits right now, that will continue, but not indefinitely. And so one of the concerns that, again, I think prompts your question is, what happens when that fund is no longer available? And Congress, again, needs to address that issue, not only because of the promises made to present and past employees in the private and governmental sectors, but also to ensure the legitimacy of this program put together, again, decades ago. The kind of thing that you articulate, which is attempts, sometimes not successful to the good of the program, to try to raid that fund, to try to find those funds, proposals that say, gee, there's an awful lot of money sitting there right now. Let's go in there and take those monies for some other purposes. Completely inappropriate given the commission of the Social Security Fund, the Social Security Agency, the Social Security package, if you will, pursuant to which government employees and private employees, the great number of people in the private sector, get benefits from that. It is a continuing issue. Continue to look at that, Katrina, as we go forward and think about what the Congress should do in that area as well. Appreciate so very much the insights, the good inquiries coming in from our callers here this afternoon on the Maggie Dawn Show, here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. A couple of other significant things going on today. Today, in the context of rule of law, legal issues, government things going on, we know that the trial of Donald Trump in Manhattan, and that Manhattan courtroom continues even to this day. To this day, we know that there have been a cavalcade of witnesses coming in, lots of documents presented, lots of fact witnesses coming in, including David Pecker, the very first witness a couple of weeks ago, describing this broad scheme in a structural definition to pay off people who had bad information, unfavorable information about then-candidate Donald Trump prior to the 2016 election. That included a woman named Karen McDougal. That included a woman named Stormy Daniels, who had information about private affairs, sexual encounters that they had with him. The attempts successful at the time to keep those reports out of the general population. As a part of that trial, we've heard not only from the David Peckers of the world, but others also coming forward, including Hope Hicks, party to and participating in the response when the Access Hollywood tape was released, and the concern about future disclosures of that. She testified. Stormy Daniels testified not too long ago also about the specific engagement that she had with Donald Trump, not only the conversation, but yes, indeed, the sexual encounter of many years ago that prompted all of this. And today and earlier this week, the so-called fixer and the longtime attorney of Donald Trump, now estranged between those two, on the stand. Today, Michael Cohen talking all about his lies. He is a witness who, again, elemental, key to the prosecution case presented by Alvin Bragg, the DA there in Manhattan. These 34 counts of criminal conduct in terms of misstating, falsifying records, presenting false and fraudulent invoices and checks and registries. Michael Cohen providing a lot of the information about that. Today, he is pressed during the course of cross-examination about his own background. Appropriate cross-examination in any criminal offense. This is what our system is all about. You test the legitimacy of all the witnesses, including today Michael Cohen, testifying that he lied before Congress and in other official proceedings as this cross-examination continues. We're going to talk more about what Michael Cohen is saying today on cross-examination, how he's holding up this key part of the prosecution case as the Maggie Dawn Show continues here on Civic Media. Is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie today, your guest host this hour and also next hour as we talk about some major developments happening just today, right now, talking about this continuing criminal trial in front of Judge Juan Merchan in Manhattan. That's right, continuing into yet a third and probably fourth and fifth week, perhaps, as the government continues to present witnesses, including in recent days, the trial testimony of former Trump attorney and fixer Michael Cohen under cross-examination. Again, a part of this process. This is what our system of justice is all about. The government presents its case, and again, a bit of civics, a good bit of law school here. It is appropriate, obviously, for the defense to try to test the legitimacy, the veracity, the accuracy of the witnesses presented by the government. Why? Because the government has the proof. In this case, as in all criminal cases, to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, if at all. And the jury hears this testimony and needs to weigh and sift and sort of measure whether or not these witnesses are credible or not. That includes tough questions of all of the witnesses. When I was a criminal and civil litigator, on a routine basis, not only do we present the testimony of fact witnesses, document witnesses, other people who describe the transactions as the prosecutors are doing this case, but also they are then subjected to testing about whether or not their perception is accurate, whether their memory is accurate. Indeed, today during cross-examination, counsel for Donald Trump asking Michael Cohen about whether he really recalls all these phone calls that he described early in the week. And Michael Cohen said this. He said, "These phone calls are things I've been talking about for the last 6 years. They are and they were extremely important and they were all consuming. What I did recall was the conversation that I had, not the specific timing of the conversation, but rather the substance of these conversations." In addition, cross-examination about whether or not Michael Cohen, in his present testimony on the stand under oath as a prosecution witness, is basically parroting the language of the very first witness. Once again, that's former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. Trump's attorney, a fellow named Todd Blanche, pointed to one detail that Cohen appeared to parrot from that earlier testimony of a couple of weeks ago. And that was a reference to the prowess, the power, the capacity that the Enquirer has for reaching many potential readers because it is sold at supermarket checkout aisles with other gossip publications. Cohen insisted, pushing back on this cross-examination just today, that he didn't learn specifics about the reference Pecker made to supermarket placement from his testimony at the start of the trial, dismissing this notion that he's simply repeating the testimony of this earlier witness. He said he only heard from other people that Pecker's story generally corroborated his. And indeed, Michael Cohen's testimony, even though it is full of baggage of his own, he's talked about his own lies to the Congress, to investigative people, to others out there, the fact that he has suffered federal convictions for lying, for deceit, for criminal conduct of his own. Nonetheless, Cohen's own testimony about what happened here, corroborated and supported by the testimony of others and the documents in this case. As to this particular issue, Trump's attorney insisting that Michael Cohen never used that phrase before his testimony at the trial. Cohen barking back, he said he only heard that Pecker confirmed what he'd been talking about for the last 6 years, not the specifics. He's also pushing back on many, many things as a part of the cross-examination of this case today. And Donald Trump, of course, sitting there listening just feet away to his former lawyer, his former fixer, as this cross-examination continues. And what is the purpose behind all of this, once again, is to test the veracity of these witnesses, and it happens in front of a jury. Their major role, their major responsibility, to look at all of these witnesses and figure out whether or not, even with the baggage, and it is huge, it is considerable, of a Michael Cohen, whether on the fundamental core things that he is testifying about, he is truthful and he is honest. He is credible. It's always about the credibility of witnesses. I would offer that while Michael Cohen is indeed attackable, and yes, indeed, he has been attacked during the course of his cross-examination, he is also credible for two reasons. One is because the information that he provides is indeed corroborated, not only by the other witnesses, including people like Hope Hicks, including the banker, the lawyer, all these other folks inside and outside of the Trump organization who collectively describe this overall scheme to pay off Stormy Daniels, to pay off Karen McDougal and others as a part of this. In addition to being corroborated by all of that testimony, the fact that Michael Cohen is not sparring about his own baggage, and once again, there is a lot. In response to the testimony, the questions of his testimony today and on previous days, what does Michael Cohen say? He says, yes, I have lied. I have lied a lot. I have told a lot of stories to members of Congress, to investigators, and I have suffered from it. I have suffered because of what I have done. My history is not a pleasant one. And he says that he wishes he could do some of that over plainly. He is trying, as he testified earlier, perhaps imperfectly, perhaps belatedly, a lot of criticism could be thrown in his direction, to try to remedy some of the things that he did. His testimony also describing this notion that he was doing this all at the behest of whom? The defendant, Donald Trump. That testimony continues even this afternoon. The court takes a break tomorrow. Among other things, the court has given Donald Trump and his wife, the former First Lady, the opportunity appropriately to attend the graduation of their son, Barron, in Florida. That will suspend proceedings tomorrow, but they begin again on Monday. And it appears that the prosecution is going to be closing up its case. It may well be that Michael Cohen is the last witness that the jury may hear. We're not sure. We won't know that until the prosecution stands up, perhaps after some redirect examination of him. If not later today, maybe Monday, maybe Tuesday or so. The court traditionally takes Wednesdays off, but highly likely that sometime next week, the prosecution case will rest in this matter. They will call no more witnesses, and then the question will be raised. What, if anything, does the defense want to present? And again, part of our civics, part of our education, our law school education, if you will. At that time, the defense has no obligation at all to present any evidence. And at that time, we will determine based upon what the defendant and his attorneys want to do, whether the case goes on, and the jurors hear even more beyond what the prosecution has presented. If indeed the prosecution rests and the defense presents no evidence, after that, the judge will begin to instruct them and ultimately give the case to the jury for its deliberation. It's entirely possible that next week at this time on this broadcast and others, that the jury could be deliberating on this all-important verdict never before happened in the history of our nation. A former president on trial. We could, in fact, get a verdict sometime in the next week or shortly thereafter, depending on what happens. The Maggie Dawn Show here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media continues into its second hour. Stay with us for all of that.